It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. 5 days after the U.S. military operation capturing and imprisoning the leader of Venezuela, Nicolas Maduro, we are getting reaction from Wisconsin's congressional delegation to these developments in South America and what comes next.
Tomorrow, we plan to hear from Democratic U.S. Representative Mark Pocan on the show.
Today, we have Republican U.S. Senator Ron Johnson with us. Senator Johnson, welcome back to Wisconsin Today.
Good morning and Happy New Year.
Thank you to you, too. Did the military operation surprise you?
Not really. President Trump was making it very clear that he was trying to get Maduro to resign, leave the country, so that it could be returned to the Venezuelan people, made multiple and very generous offers to Maduro. And, you know, we obviously were inhibiting their ability to export oil. And, you know, so in the end, President Trump took military action. It was, by the way, an incredible success. Our briefing by General Kane was, again, impressive. You know, the ability of the finest among us, men and women of the armed forces is tremendous. And so no loss of life on our side. And it's undeniably good that Maduro is no longer running Venezuela. And we'll see what happens next.
Congress has constitutional authority to declare war. Was Congress left out here? Are you concerned about the precedent this sets for a president to bypass Congress?
No, because there are plenty of precedents before this where presidents do take action in the face of national security threats. Let's face it, Maduro was not the legitimate president of Venezuela. He was running Venezuela as a narco-terrorist state. Something like 8 million Venezuelans had fled the country. Again, he was given multiple chances. You can see that President Trump does not want to do nation building. We didn't leave any troops on the ground, and we used the oil and our ability to use Western resources to use that oil and other resources to Venezuela for the benefit of the Venezuelan people, for Venezuela, for the Western Hemisphere, and for America. I mean, this is, there was way too much foreign influence from our adversaries, Iran, Cuba, Russia, China. And, you know, this is basically a reinstitution of the Monroe Doctrine.
President Trump says Venezuela will turn over 30 to 50 million barrels of oil to the U.S. Administration says the U.S. will take control of that oil, sell it indefinitely. Do you support these moves?
That's the way we'll be able to transition Venezuela to a country that, again, is more in line with the Western countries and our economies for the benefit of the Venezuelan people. Right now, it's been run by a bunch of oligarchs, and they've been stealing the money, impoverishing Venezuela. So it makes perfect sense to me. Again, they're going to take the oil, sell it in the open market, deposit it into an account, not the Federal Reserve, but a separate account that will then be used to pay, for example, civil servants in Venezuela. So this is, again, this is going to be a win-win for Venezuela, for the Western Hemisphere, and for America.
You've been in briefings all week on this military operation. You know, President Trump telling the New York Times last night the U.S. would be running Venezuela for years. How does that sit with you?
Again, I'm listening to what Secretary Rubio is telling us in terms of the details of that. And you can focus on the word run, but we're certainly going to make sure that the narco-terrorism ends, that the resources of Venezuela are utilized for the benefit of the Venezuelan people and the country, as well as the benefit of the Western Hemisphere in America. Again, this is going to be a good thing. There are, you know, many challenges. You know, I don't know. I don't know the number of narco-terrorists that are still there, how many Cuban advisors are still there. That's one of the reasons President Trump didn't want to leave American boots on the ground. He's going to give the base, currently the people that are in there. There are plenty of people that were opposed to Maduro still serving in government that are happy to see him leave. I'm sure there are other people that are the narco-terrorist group that are not going to like the fact that they can't expropriate, you know, the billions of dollars in oil revenue for themselves, not for the benefit of the Venezuelan people. So, again, there's nothing guaranteed here, but this is movement in the right direction.
So if Venezuela does not cooperate on any particular step the U.S. is taking, do you support bringing U.S. troops into Venezuela? Do you support troops on the ground?
want to avoid that at all cost. Again, they are at a huge disadvantage. Right now they have an enormous liquidity crisis, and that's where the fact that we can sell that oil for them, turn that over back to civil society for the benefit of Venezuelan people, I think that'll be what in the end will be successful and not require American troops. Again, there may be some I cannot tell you how many narco-terrorist groups are already there, what kind of armed resistance there may be there. But I think just the stunning success of what America was able to do this was a secure location. The fact that we were able to get in and get out without any American service people's loss of life and capture Maduro and his wife as efficiently as we did, that sends a powerful signal to our adversaries, both in Venezuela and elsewhere around the world.
Looping back to the role of Congress in all of this, a vote is coming very soon on a war powers resolution in the Senate that would require congressional authorization for military force against Venezuela. How will you vote?
I'll vote no. I mean, I don't think there's a president who's ever recognized the constitutionality of the War Powers Act. It's never been really argued in front of the Supreme Court. So, again, our Constitution gives the president of the United States a great deal of power in terms of dealing with foreign relations, national security, the commander-in-chief, and previous presidents of both parties have utilized that power. President Trump's doing the same thing. And again, this Operation Venezuela was a spectacular success that I think most Americans are glad that Maduro's out of there and that the Venezuelan people have a chance to rebuild their country into something where there's greater democracy and freedom.
Okay, so stabilizing Venezuela for years to come, how will this all affect U.S. taxpayers? How will this affect Wisconsin taxpayers?
If anything, it'll be a benefit to us. It's not going to be a drain on our resources. Again, this is carried out by military operation. We fund the military to just about $1 trillion a year. There's no additional money really spent, marginally, relatively small amount. And the potential increase in prosperity for both Venezuela and the Western Hemisphere in America, I think, will more than offset any cost of guaranteeing the security of Venezuela.
Well, let's talk more about this Western Hemisphere military actions in Venezuela. They're raising concerns in other countries. President Trump also threatened to oust the president of Colombia, made similar comments about Cuba. Should other leaders be removed from power?
Other leaders need to stop trafficking drugs into America and killing Americans. And again, they watched very carefully what we did in Venezuela. That will hopefully be a real deterrence and get them to decide to take President Trump his word that they continue doing things that are harmful to America and Americans, action may be taken. Again, I think that's a good thing. The strike in Venezuela is a deterrent action to hopefully prevent future action. Again, this is called peace through strength, and that's what President Trump is demonstrating.
Peace through strength. Is that the end game here? Is that what success looks like?
Yes, we want stability. It's tragic what has happened to Venezuela. I mean, it should be a highly wealthy and prosperous nation, but it's been basically raped and plundered by socialists. Socialism doesn't work. It destroys economies. I mean, 8 million Venezuelans fled. Maduro, there were no human rights. I mean, there are just summary executions of people who didn't support or spoke out against the Maduro regime. This is a bad person, okay? So this gives the Venezuelans real opportunity, and those opportunities ought to exist in Colombia and Cuba as well.
Before we have to let you go, your comment yesterday in Minneapolis on the ICE agent shooting and killing a woman in her car, there is video of this footage. Have you seen that footage, and do you think there should be consequences for that ICE agent?
I think most Americans have seen it. It's a tragedy all the way around. I think what I would like to see is that elected officials stop inciting people to impede lawful operations. Don't obstruct justice. Don't put yourself at risk. I mean, again, this is a tragedy all the way around. It didn't have to happen.
What should happen to the ICE agent? This is apparently pretty common
for these protesters to use vehicles to ram ICE agents. ICE agents have been put at risk. that they're protecting themselves as well. Again,
there should be no consequences for that ICE agent.
That'll be adjudicated, but okay. Law enforcement agents have every right to defend themselves, and you've got a large vehicle barreling toward itself when you're already on alert. Listen, I'm going to side generally with law enforcement.
Senator Johnson, thank you so much for joining us.
Have a good day.
You too. That was Wisconsin's U.S. Senator Ron Johnson. And tomorrow we'll hear from Democratic Representative Mark Pocan, who is expected to join us at the top of the show.
Now we'll hear from other members of Wisconsin's congressional delegation as they've been responding to the U.S. military operation in Venezuela in recent days.
Yesterday, Wisconsin Senator Tammy Baldwin posted a video on social media calling President Trump distracted and helping out his, quote, billionaire buddies. Here's what she had to say.
This was about oil. Maduro is a brutal dictator. You know, I'm very clear-eyed on that. But it's another thing for Trump to say this is about making an arrest. And then minutes later saying, well, no, this is actually the U.S. taking control of Venezuelan oil reserves.
On Monday, House Republican Scott Fitzgerald was interviewed on Fox Business. He said the U.S. needs the ability to make sure nearby countries aren't a threat. Here's a listen.
The more analysis and the more I hear those that have a legitimate opinion about what happened, and if you just take kind of what Secretary Hegseth said kind of at face value, this is strictly a law enforcement type of operation with support from the U.S. military.
And we're gathering your reaction to the developments in Venezuela and what happens next. Have you been following the events there, the ouster of President Maduro? What do you think about it? Has the Trump administration overstepped its authority, or was the military raid the right move in helping to protect American interests over the Western Hemisphere?
Leave us a message. Send us a text at 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232. Or email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. We hope to incorporate your perspective in a future conversation.
Coming up, two longtime Wisconsin VA healthcare workers tell us about the impact of federal cuts on VA staffing.
The organization is making it such that people feel like they have to find a different job. They can't stay there anymore. So people are dropping out and not being replaced.
That's next on Wisconsin Today. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Department of Veterans Affairs recently announced that it will not fill tens of thousands of open job positions.
The department said on social media it'll close at least 25,000 vacant jobs, saying most of them were added during the COVID-19 pandemic and are unnecessary. That's on top of around 30,000 VA staff cuts last year from early retirement, deferred resignations, and a hiring freeze.
An open letter from hundreds of VA workers back in October warned that cuts would, quote, negatively affect the lives of all veterans.
Two staffers who recently left Wisconsin VA hospitals join us now. Michelle Malone is president of Local 3 AFGE, a union for federal employees in the Milwaukee area. She retired from the Zablocki VA Medical Center in September. And Dr. Michael Siebers is a retired Veterans Health Administration physician in Madison. Dr. Siebers practiced at the William S. Middleton Memorial Veterans Hospital for 27 years. Dr. Siebers, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
And Michelle, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Michelle, let's start with you. You were working pretty recently at the Zablocki VA Medical Center in Milwaukee. We had a lot of cuts last year with the VA and more now unfilled positions, apparently. Were you seeing these kind of shortages showing up at Zablocki?
Yes, there's been a lot of shortages. It's been really crazy. I'm still active in the VA because I'm president of AFGE, the Local 3, the union. And so it's like to where everybody's been working short. Nobody, you know, could get off. You know, they're taking away their time off, you know, their annual leave, and, you know, not allowing sick leave because they're so short. They've been cutting beds, you know, in our domiciliary. I think they cut it like 30 beds and then turned around to cut a whole wing And so, I mean, it's just, it's hurting the veterans. It's the care, the veterans' care is really being hurt by this cut.
And Michelle, is it a case where, hey, that nurse who might have covered, you know, a certain number of patients, depending on if they're critical care or whatever, those numbers are going up? It's one nurse for more patients now?
Correct. Yes. It's where they might have had maybe four patients, you know, but now they're like at eight. At least it doubled, if not tripled.
And what are you hearing, Michelle, about morale with the people you work with?
Well, the morale is so low, and it's to where that, you know, it's to where that, I mean, they need this job to help their families, to live. But then they're terrified. They're terrified that they're going to lose their job. They're terrified. The supervisor is constantly saying, hey, you need to do more with less, do more with less. I mean, they love working for the veterans, but they don't, you know, they don't have the amount of people that they need to do the job, you know, and it's not like they don't want to do it. They love working for the veterans.
Dr. Siebers, you were a doctor in the VA system for a long time. I imagine, you know, the agency was never so flush with employees that there were, you know, it never felt tight. But do you see things being different now over the last year?
It's terribly different and for the worse.
What kind of things are you hearing? How are you concerned about what this might mean for a veteran seeking medical care?
Well, it's bad for the staff. You know, a quarter of the staff are veterans themselves, and the morale is very low, and the organization is making it such that people feel like they have to find a different job. They can't stay there anymore. So people are dropping out and not being replaced. So when the Veterans Administration talks about we're not firing anybody, we're not reducing staff, we're only getting rid of vacant positions, they're vacant positions that they have forced into the system. And from the patient's point of view, services are not as readily available as they have been in the past. One of the most egregious problems is for veterans who have mental health issues. The organization, the Veterans Administration, is now starting to try to put a limit on the number of visits that veterans with mental health issues can attend. And of course, we lose a veteran to suicide one an hour. So this is a very critical area for veterans.
And Dr. Siebers, as I understand it, I think for physicians in particular, working for the VA may not be the most lucrative option compared to elsewhere in the healthcare sector. Is that true? Does it make it in general more complicated for the VA to keep attracting physicians on staff?
In general, physicians who work in the VA make less money than physicians in private practice. Most employees at the VA, as has already been stated, love their work. They love working for veterans. They love helping veterans. So that makes up for a lot of shortcomings in other areas. And there are many reports of, say, for example, psychologists who have been forced out of the system who find employment elsewhere and make considerably more money. And this is, you know, not just for physicians, but for other providers in the Veterans Administration system.
And Michelle, on that same note, the colleagues you work with, you mentioned some people thinking, hey, I need to look into another line of work. Are you seeing people leave the VA and go into the healthcare system and other agencies or in private practice?
Yes, a lot of them has, because sometimes it's so unbearable for them to do that job that they're asking them to do with so short staff, and they're really looking for, you know, they're asking for the help, but they're not getting the help, but they're still having a deadline to meet certain criteria, but it's just not happening, and they just put their hands up and say, I had enough. And I mean, professional and unprofessional employees have been doing that.
Michelle, we've seen from the Veterans Administration moves toward saying, hey, we're going to give veterans flexibility where they can seek help at a VA, a hospital or clinic. or have a voucher kind of thing to go to see a private practitioner. Is that kind of private practice something that's going to make up for some of these shortfalls we see at the VA, or are you worried about that as a trend?
I'm very worried about that, because if you ever visit a VA hospital, you would see how the veterans like to interact with other veterans. I mean, that's their hospital. So then to have to go to any private hospital to where they don't have the respect of being a veteran. This is theirs. And I think to take away the VA hospital is to take away a lot from the veterans. They earned this thing. They put their life on the line, and we should not be taking away their hospital. I mean, I can't believe that they would even consider something like that.
Dr. Siebers, do you see the VA as being uniquely situated to be able to provide care and as Michelle mentioned, the respect for veterans as compared to the rest of the healthcare system?
That's absolutely the case. You know, current administration is talking about the private sector as being a good place for resources to go for veterans' health care, but they're looking at giving out big contracts to different companies for the care of veterans without regard to really the issues that veterans have. You know, there's the PTSD, the substance abuse, the lung cancer and so forth from smoking. So, yeah, that's a significant difference from the system that's available now in the veteran system, where a patient can get an appointment at least previously. Now, this has been eroded significantly in the past year, but an appointment for a veteran would be a half hour. And in a private practice setting, the appointment is 10 minutes. In the VA system, it may take a month or two to get the appointment. In the private setting, we all know it takes 3 months or more to get an appointment. So saying that the private sector is going to be able to handle the veterans, well, really all the administration is doing is passing off money to cronies they work with. I'm sorry to sound so cynical.
Dr. Siebers, the VA has been heavily studied over the years. What do we know about the quality of care that veterans receive in VA facilities?
The one statistic that comes immediately to mind is a survey that was done in 2023, and 91% of veterans were highly satisfied with the care they got in the Veterans Administration system. As you know, it's the largest integrated healthcare system in the country. And the current administration is trying to destroy it.
We are talking about recently announced cuts to staffing at the Veterans Administration, especially in the health field. We've got Dr. Michael Siebers, retired doctor who spent more than a quarter century working at the VA hospital in South Central Wisconsin. Michelle Malone, also with us, president of Local 3 AFGE and former staffer at Zablocki Medical Center in Milwaukee. Michelle, another move from the Trump administration. President Trump signed an executive order removing collective bargaining rights from unions at federal agencies like the VA. The head of your group called that a retaliation, a suing over the executive order. Has this impacted your chapter's ability to represent workers at that facility?
Yes, it has. It has really, it's kind of damaging because we can't represent people in our, you know, they said they won't let us talk up for just this past Friday. I got a call from one of our members stating that they were in a building that had no heat or no running water, that then they told them they could not go home and work from home, that they had to stay there. And it was like 60 degrees in the building and there was no running water to use the bathroom or anything. So, and I'm calling, trying to get HR, say, hey, what you guys doing about this? What you doing? And they refused to talk to me about that because they said that bargaining, that they weren't my bargaining members anymore. But they are people. They are people that needs to be treated with respect and shown this is how these are working conditions. And I feel that if we don't if we don't say something now, do something now, it's going to just spread wide open, and it's going to hurt everybody. This is not just going to stay in that one area. It's just going to get bigger and bigger, and it's going to start coming outside of the VA. It's not going to just it's not going to start here. You give them an inch, and they're going to take the mile.
Michelle, are nurses, for example, concerned that, hey, if I try to raise concerns about conditions affecting patient safety, I might face retaliation?
Yes, you know, because I've talked to some nurses before, and, you know, they said that, you know, they were saying things about how the patients, they felt that the patients weren't getting the care that they wanted, but then they said if they were to say a whistleblow, then, you know, then they become a target.
Dr. Siebers, I'm talking to two retired employees at the VA. Are you concerned that people who are still there, still trying to keep a job, are being silenced, in effect, not able to raise concerns publicly?
Oh, there's no question about the silencing. The upper administration in each hospital has been forced to sign non-disclosure forms. And people down the pecking order can see what's happening in other areas. If you Google cuts at the VA, you'll see cuts at, you know, many other agencies. And it's the same administration that's doing all these different kind of cuts and intimidation of workers.
Dr. Siebers, I'm talking to people who've been with, you know, in the Madison area and the Milwaukee area. There's also the big Toma facility. I've heard some concerns that, you know, even before the latest cuts, we had, you know, in northern Wisconsin, people had to go a long way to get various kinds of specialty treatment. In your career there, did you see yourself serving a lot of people coming from maybe up in northern Wisconsin? And are you worried that cuts might make things harder for them?
At the Middleton VA Hospital, we always would have transfers from Toma Hospital and other facilities that are in our catchment area in the VA. You know, this is true even in the private sector. If you have a certain type of problem, you're in a small community hospital, if that community hospital still exists, and you have a complicated case, they're going to send you to a different medical center. So that is an issue, and it's something that's can be difficult. I didn't allude to this earlier when I mentioned the difference between the private community and the Veterans Administration hospitals. But the Veterans Administration hospitals has a whole separate system of electronic medical record that's incompatible with other medical records. So if a veteran goes to a private facility, his record doesn't go with him. And that can be extremely detrimental.
Michelle, if, say, a member of Congress came to you or somebody high up in the VA and said, okay, we're probably not going to be able to reverse all these cuts, but what are your top priorities? What are some small changes that you think could make a big difference? What would you tell them?
I would tell them to give the people back their rights to have the union to represent them. I would tell them to that our veterans need more care. They work for us, and it's time for us to go ahead and get staff the VA the way it should be to care for our veterans.
Dr. Siebers, I've seen some concern expressed by people raising concerns about the VA that, you know, people hearing a conversation like this, veterans hearing a conversation like this, might think, oh, my God, I shouldn't go to the VA to seek my health care. What is your message to them? Should they still be seeking care from the VA, even with the concerns that the two of you are raising?
Well, I would say they should seek care there. Now, I'm talking about two different situations. One, someone who's already a veteran with established care, and second, a veteran who doesn't have established care but is interested in entering the Veterans Administration healthcare system. For the latter group, the sooner you get into the system, the more likely you are to have a favorable benefit profile, because some of the things that are being talked about have to do with the nitty-gritty of how the VA system works. So, for example, a copay for someone who's less than 30% service-connected or no services available at all. So that kind of thing can make a big difference. So veterans should register and use the VA system to the extent they are able and to the extent that it is beneficial for them.
Dr. Siebers, at some point in your career, you trained at the VA hospital. You entered a career there. For somebody going into the medical field now, just out of medical school, saying, gosh, you know, I'd love to work with veterans in this community, what advice would you give them if they're seeking a career in the VA in the current situation?
Really, it's difficult to tell people to work at the VA right now because the Trump administration has said they want to close the VA hospitals. And when they talk about having better care for veterans, all they're talking about is putting more money in the basket to use for care that veterans get in the community. On the other hand, it's a privilege and an honor to take care of veterans. And anyone who wants to do so, I would say, go for it, recognizing what the shortcomings are.
We'll leave it there. Dr. Siebers, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And Michelle, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Dr. Michael Siebers is a retired Veterans Health Administration physician in Madison. Dr. Siebers practiced at the William S. Middleton Memorial Veterans Hospital for 27 years. And Michelle Malone is president of Local 3 AFGE, a union for federal employees in the Milwaukee area. She retired from the Zablocki Medical Center in September.
Coming up, a Milwaukee author shares a new horror novel inspired by movies and Midwestern winters.
That feeling of the cold that makes you feel very alone, but it also kind of makes you feel alive a little bit.
The novel is called Poltergeist. That's up next. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Picture this. You wake up one day and the world is empty. There's a hazy blue coloring to everything.
You try to piece together what your life was like before, but all you can remember are fragments of old horror movies you've watched.
That's the premise of Poltergeist, a new novel from a Wisconsin film professor who was very literally picturing those scenes as she wrote the book.
It's filled with Easter eggs for fans of classic horror films like The Thing and The Changeling, and there's some inspiration from Wisconsin landscapes as well.
Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies is Associate Professor and Director of Film Studies at UW-Milwaukee. Poltergeist is her first novel. Jocelyn, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me on, Rob.
All right. For years, from our WPR-centric perspective, you've been our go-to Wisconsin movie person. Now you're writing a book. Coming from that background as somebody who really is deep into film, what made you want to tackle a novel?
Well, I've actually always been a voracious reader as well. So I'm really interested in storytelling in general, whether that's visual or whether that's written. So actually, books are pretty much almost as much a love for me as the movies. But one of the things that I've been really interested in as I've gone deeper into my career as a film historian is how we can kind of bridge this gap between the visual and the written. Movies, as far as I understand them, they really have kind of infected our subconscious. They're a part of our history. They're a part of who we are. And so I was really interested in thinking about how to combine that sort of subconscious level of film with telling a story in a novel form.
So when you're writing, are you thinking, you know, how would this look? What would this look like through the lens?
Absolutely. I personally really love novels that are cinematic in scope, that give you a lot of description, that give you a lot of scene setting where you can
really feel where you are. You feel immersed just like you are in a film. So for me, that definitely is something that I wanted to create and a kind of atmosphere that I wanted to provide.
And filmmakers will have like kind of a color palette either throughout a movie or to set apart different scenes or characters. And this book, a lot of it has this hazy blue sheen that kind of is illuminating everything. And it kind of comes through in the words. Did you think through again, like a filmmaker might, about your color palette and what that was going to look like?
I'm so glad you recognize that, because a lot of the genesis of this book was actually thinking of this sort of post-apocalyptic imagery that is very much located in a color. And as you noted, it's this hazy blue, but it's not supposed to be a kind of natural blue like we would see in a sunny sky or the sparkles on Lake Michigan or anything like that. Instead, it's supposed to be this kind of blue that's at the end of things, right? This haze that drapes over the world when the world is about to end. And that is really where so much of the main idea came from, was that sense of a kind of almost rotted blue that to me is very similar to the color of static on television. So absolutely, it was that kind of imagery of the color that sort of was the nascent of how I was thinking about this novel.
Now, here's a surprisingly tricky question, asking you what happens in the book, the plot of the book, because as a reader, we come in and we don't know what the heck is going on, and that emerges very slowly. And that's kind of the point, I think. So when somebody says, hey, Jocelyn, what's your book about? What do you tell them without spoiling the discoveries that you make along the way?
Right. I like to say that it's about a single figure, an unnamed woman, who doesn't know who she is. She doesn't know where she is. And she finds herself completely alone at what seems to be the end of the world. So that's the kind of general approach that I will give people. But I also want them to understand that it's about a lot more than that. It's about who are we if there's nobody else to think about ourselves in concert with? What is somebody's identity if they're all alone? And if all of humanity has disappeared, what then does being a human being mean at all? But I was also thinking about it in terms of being about how we understand religion, how we understand belief, and what kinds of promises or potentially false signals that belief systems can grant us.
Well, that's a lot to pack into what's not that long a book. You really bit off a lot there.
I did. Hopefully it wasn't more than I could actually achieve, but the book originally came to me partially from a dream image. So that's one of the origins of it, was this dream image of this this sort of Arctic outpost in an Arctic that is no longer the Arctic, an Arctic that has kind of melted. And that dream image was so provocative to me when I woke up that it was something that kind of guided the rest of the story for me. And I find that dreams themselves, they also bite off more than they can chew, right? Like there's so many ideas that come to us in dreams. And it's like, how did all of that get packed into what was probably 2 minutes, right, of actually being asleep? So in some sense, that impulse to pack a lot in comes from this genesis of the book as a dream image.
Now, a weird coincidence. The day we're talking, we've had a lot of snow. It's a warm day. There's mist. Things are melting. If you're going to film your book, today would be a good day to be out filming it, I think. Did the Wisconsin landscape help flesh out that image that started in a dream?
The Wisconsin landscape has so much to do with this book. It doesn't take place in Wisconsin. It takes place in an Arctic that has melted. But I'm not originally from Wisconsin. I'm from the Mid-Atlantic. So when I moved here, I had to get used to these massive snowstorms that were just, I mean, they're like apocalyptic when they happen. And it certainly was something that I really wasn't super familiar with being from Maryland. Over the years, that became something that I loved about the state. But it's also been something that I've seen start to go away a little bit. It was just, I think, 2 winters ago that we basically had no snow cover whatsoever. And certainly northern towns in Wisconsin that are used to a lot of recreational snow activity, they were suffering that winter. So much of the feeling of being in the north affected how I think about being in the world, and thus affected this book in general. But at the same time, that feeling of the snow disappearing and that beauty of the ice evaporating and eroding, that brings up a kind of melancholy. And that melancholy affected this book too and made me think about what I wanted the environmental collapse that's at the center of the book to really be about. That feeling of the cold that makes you feel very alone, but it also kind of makes you feel alive a little bit. What happens when that starts to dissipate?
And you mentioned part of the book is in part about isolation. Who are we when we're not out among mm-hmm. other people? And gosh, that sounds a little bit familiar too. Like in COVID, a lot of people had to figure out questions like that. They were maybe at home with family, maybe at home alone. Was that part of the feeder of these ideas in the book?
Absolutely. It's probably no surprise that the book was written in the waning days of COVID. Around 2021, 2022 was when I wrote it. And certainly, what did it mean for us to be people at that time when we weren't interacting with our loved ones, when we weren't around other people so much? We all retreated into ourselves. That's kind of like what happens in Wisconsin winters, right? We retreat into ourselves. What happens when you retreat into yourself? It can be a space of total generative possibility, right? When you retreat into your own caverns of the deepest parts of yourself, you might find inspiration, you might find imagination and idea, but you also might find real pits of loneliness, right? Real sadness. How do we then distinguish what we should take from being in those caverns of solitude and what we should leave there? What do we trust when we are only in this space of pure isolation? So yeah, COVID had so much to do with it as well.
We're talking to Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies, UW-Milwaukee film professor, new novel, an apocalyptic horror story called Poltergeist. Jocelyn, you've described this as a work of weird horror, which I think is kind of a subgenre of horror. What do we mean when we say weird horror?
Yeah, there's a lot of debates as to what weird horror means today. But the way that I think about it is it's horror that does not explain itself. Some very strange things happen. You're never going to get the author telling you exactly what it all means. It's not going to get all tied up. And hopefully it's going to leave you with a feeling of deep uncanniness, right? That things are just not quite right. So I would say, you know, slashers don't usually fit into weird horror. Even a lot of ghost stories don't necessarily, because we often find out that the ghosts have a reason for why they're haunting. Weird horror wants to give you that feeling of just being deeply unsettled, like nothing can be fully explained. One of the main progenitors of weird horror that we often look to is H.P. Lovecraft, of course, with his cosmic horror. A lot of problems with Lovecraft, of course, but he certainly was good at providing that sort of atmosphere where you never fully understand what is happening. You just know it's not right. I think weird horror now is a subgenre that is really appealing for people who don't see how the world is entirely legible or explainable anymore. And that's why it's kind of an appealing subgenre for me.
All right. And Jocelyn, I've held off on one of the most striking things about the book. It's definitely in conversation with horror movies. And there are so many that the main character is remembering sort of all these different movies, from The Thing by John Carpenter, Poltergeist, of course, which it shares a title with. I should have been writing them all down. There were so many. How did you bring those movies in? How did you approach that?
Yeah, so this is also in keeping with my point that movies have kind of infected us, right? They are in our subconscious. They're in our dreams. We have completely integrated them into who we are, at least in this country. I would say that they're really deeply a part of the American consciousness. So in order to experiment with that, not just like in a class where I might teach movies that way, I wanted to give a sense of the character having these movies come up in her subconscious. I tried really hard never to name the
right
film in the book. The goal was that they would also sort of ring some distant bells in the reader's head. So as you read the description of the film, you might begin to realize, oh, that's the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. oh, that's the changeling. And they would start to bubble up in your head, much as they're bubbling up in the protagonist's head. So the idea was to kind of create this structure of film as subconscious material. Hopefully that's what came through.
Was there a lot of film watching as you were preparing this? Were you going back and watching these movies for inspiration as to how to bring them into the novel?
All the movies that are discussed in it are movies that I find really fascinating or have thought about a lot for one reason or another. And I did think about when I was writing it, should I go back and make sure that I'm getting these details right? But what I actually ended up deciding was that would be counter to what my goal was, which was to make them operate not as the movies themselves, but as memories of movies. So I thought it actually made more sense to rely on my own memory of them, which is pretty good. Most of them I've seen multiple times, but I wanted them to have that kind of sense of haziness where you recognize it, you're not entirely sure that it's right. So it was a deliberate choice on my part.
Right. Maybe this is too meta, Jocelyn, but I was thinking while reading the book that had a lot of movie references in it, what would it be like to make a movie out of this book? And there's some weird, surreal stuff as I was reading, like, could you even film that? Could you even animate that? I don't know. What do you have thoughts on that?
I would absolutely love to see this book as a movie. I have no idea how you do it with probably with copyright problems for all the films that are talked about in it. But to me, there are scenes that I just envisioned as movie scenes. So there is this cat in it, who's my favorite character in the book. As a cat person, I know that cats are both the most lovable animals and the most terrifying, horrible tornadoes of all time. So this cat figure in it, I don't want to give too much away, but the cat tries to convince the protagonist that it's a god. And it's very mean. It's very cruel to her. It's like extremely mean. But I really just could picture this white Persian cat in my head, this really rotten, nasty white Persian cat, but that's so beautiful and has these crystal clear blue eyes. And in my head, I just loved seeing that cat on the screen of my imagination. That cat, I think, should be a star.
Now, sometimes in horror, in movies or books, sometimes it's like, you know, the horror is shocking, right? The horrible thing happens out of nowhere. And sometimes it's the kind of scary thing that keeps you awake at night. And then there's the kind of like creepy, unsettling genre of horror. And I think that's where the book falls closest to me. Am I right? Or am I hitting the sweet spot you were aiming for there?
Absolutely. It's about mood. It's about atmosphere. It's about a sustained mood. It's part of why I didn't want it to be very long, because if you're writing something primarily for mood, you can lose your audience if you go on for too long. But it's definitely more supposed to be about giving you a sense of the creeps, right? Making you feel like you inhabit this world for a while. It's about taking you on a journey of absolute atmosphere, where by the end of it, you feel a little bit changed. So those were kind of some things that I was thinking about.
Jocelyn, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies, Associate Professor and Director of Film Studies at UW-Milwaukee, and now first-time fiction author. Her new book is called Poltergeist. It's an apocalyptic horror story filled with movie references. Jocelyn will do a book event at Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee on Thursday, February 5th at 6:30 p.m.
As people deal with their health care coverage needs this year, some businesses are exploring a different model. It's direct primary care, where patients or businesses purchase memberships, in effect, with local doctors.
We're going to dig into that model on the show. And if you are using direct primary care for yourself or maybe your employees, we want to include your voice in the conversation.
Get in touch with us. You can email wisconsintoday@wpr.org or call or text us at 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232. And thanks for contributing. Wisconsin Today producers include Beatrice Lawrence, Trevor Hook, and Rochelle Wilson.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.